assimilate or present it as the same as the resistance of social movements. In Ecuador today, a country of almost 18 million inhabitants, we have 5 million inhabitants who live with only $3 a day and almost 3 million who live on $1.50 a day. And 66% of jobs are informal.
6% de los empleos son informales.
That is the reality of Ecuador.
Novoa, en medio de esta guerra, la
in the midst of this war on crime, Noboa has unleashed a number of privatization actions, for example, in electricity, raising the prices for the population.
Y subir incluso las tarifas de la misma la población. Noboa, en esta guerra contra la delincuencia, ha condonado la deuda.
Noboa, in this war against crime, has forgiven the debt of large economic groups, and yet he has raised or proposed the raising VAT by 3 points at this moment. That will rise to 15%, which is a lot in a country with a dollarized policy.
La guerra a la delincuencia ha traído.
The war on crime has brought his friends from the leadership of the Southern Command, headed by Laura Richardson, to organize the country. The North Americans are there, because today they enter Ecuador without any inspection of their documents, or what they bring. In any case, when they leave, they're not inspected either. That's the agreement they reached. The police and soldiers who arrive in Ecuador, according to what they have agreed, will not have to give any account to the Ecuadorian authorities, even if they commit the most cruel crimes.
Aunque cometan delitos de los más crueles, ninguno.
And they can walk freely in the country. That's the reality.
Esa es la realidad.
The weapons of Russian origin that were in Ecuador. What do you think about that?
¿Qué creen? Se lo pasó Noboa.
Noboa passed them under the Pentagon. That happened also to those of Chinese origin. All are to be sent to Ukraine. A Ukrainian plane belonging to Zelensky landed a few days ago in Quito.
Un avión ucraniano de Zelensky aterrizó hace pocos días en Quito. De cualquier manera,
in any case, sovereignty, independence, and social rights today have blatantly receded in Ecuador.
En forma descarada en Ecuador.
Ecuador is stopping to be a country and is becoming a factory. The problem for us, the Latin Americans, is that the United States is planning for the rest of our continent. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Eduardo Artes. Bien, hoy estamos con.
Well, today we're with Irene Leon from Ecuador. Ecuadorian sociologist, political analyst, and member of the World Social Forum, WFS, since its inception in
2021.
Also a member of the Social Forum of the Americas and the Network of Intellectuals, Artists, and Social Movements in Defense of Humanity. Welcome to Black and White.
Bienvenida a Negro y Blanco.
Hello, I'm very happy to be with you in this program, and at this time, I'm at your service.
Irene, ¿qué pasa en Ecuador?
Irene, what is going on in Ecuador? What is the story of criminals and drug traffickers? Is there a power struggle in Ecuador?
En Ecuador, asaltan una.
They attacked a television channel. The same thing is said about the social groups. In many cases, social organizations are accused of terrorism. The topic of conversation is not drug traffickers, but terrorists. What is the foundation of these issues? What is really going on in Ecuador?
Well, I think the key to this is the condition that Ecuador is in. Since more than 6 years ago, there was a promise of change in Ecuador, change and transformation of the country with a governance and project definition for the country and based on different dimensions of such issues. Ecuador wanted to implement socialism and good life, which has the support of the constitution. Our constitution is considered one of the most advanced constitutions in the world. Ecuador was once the second country in Latin America and the Caribbean, but since 6 years ago, the country has plunged into what I call a neoliberal coup. In other words, an attempt to restore neoliberalism to the country at any cost. Since then, our country has been grappling with legal war, political persecution, and judicial and media imposition based on some scenarios. In the end, all this case creates an environment in which politics, definition of the country and country management within the framework of the provisions of the constitution remain only in words and on paper. Therefore, in the same period of time, with the opening of the market and the governance of the country, various centers of illegal capital have been established in the country to provide the basis for neoliberal actions. The main focus is close to financial capital because Ecuador is a dollarized country. Ecuador lost its national currency more than 20 years ago, and the US dollar prevailed through Ecuador. Therefore, these conditions have prepared the ground for various money laundering operations and unauthorized transactions. In these transactions, financial capital is transferred. Therefore, this financial flow is related to illegal businesses and is known as financial capital bank. It's very important that a turnaround has taken place in Ecuador and is taking place. In addition to illegal capital, there is the export sector, which is also very important, as well as the international trade sector, where there is also a possibility that illegal capital circulates in these sectors. Also, there are sections related to human trafficking and other trafficking, including drug trafficking. Therefore, I say all these issues to explain that this problem that exists is caused by the structural orientations of the country and the region. In this problem, the proceeds of these businesses, which are considered illegitimate, go into neoliberal and free market activities where different actors and sectors interact with each other, as I mentioned. As a part of these activities and shrinking the government, which is a part of neoliberalism, in Ecuador we see the transfer of power to powerful institutions, factual powers, that I mentioned. So all the trends that we're talking about, including attacks, drug trafficking, and a certain kind of violence that is seen, are caused by the opening of the market doors in Ecuador, the de-governance in the country, and the return of neoliberalism against the good life constitution in Ecuador. The constitution, contrary to this trend, defines Ecuador as a country with a multi-sector and diverse economy, whose production is also multi-sector and diverse. Ecuador plays a pivotal role in the structure of regional integration and Latin America and South America.
Yes, that's correct. We're going to take a short break. I think it became very clear that the root of this problem is the neoliberal system. We'll be back in a few seconds. We're back with Irene Leon from Ecuador in Black and White. Irene, so far we feel that the actions taken by the young Noboa government are a clear abuse of the true crime situation.
Del joven Noboa, que hay un aprovechamiento.
You have explained this situation very well, how this situation is connected with large economic groups. Let's be frank that the goal of Noboa is to drag the country into the mouth of American imperialism, that is, to bring the American military and announcing it.
Porque la llegada de las tropas norteamericanas o los anuncios de las mismas.
How should be described the presence of Laura Richardson? What do these agreements mean? 124 projects are planned for this year, and it's supposed to last for 5 years.
24 actividades ya planificadas y van a estar 5 años, ¿no? ¿Cómo ese fortalece la presencia militar, policial?
How will these actions strengthen the U.S. military and police presence? In addition to the Manta base issue and the Galapagos becoming some kind of natural aircraft carrier, it seems they're taking advantage of this economic crisis, a crisis of crime, economics, privatization, increased VAT, etc. What else is in this?
Intelectual, económica, privatizaciones, subida del IVA, etc. ¿No hay algo más en esto?
I think you touched on one of the central issues that is happening in Ecuador. We're not alone in our own country, and part of what is happening is due to differences regarding the country's model and orientation at the domestic level, which is related to the international geopolitical environment. But the United States is a very important player that has a geostrategic agenda for the region as well, for Latin America. In this framework, Ecuador has its own interests due to its geopolitical position and being located in the middle of the globe and benefiting from preferred ports in the Pacific Ocean due to several factors. And in addition, it is considered a key country for the new geostrategic arrangement and the hemisphere proposed by the United States. Therefore, the changes that have been taking place in Ecuador since 6 years ago, as I mentioned earlier, have a close relationship with the alignment of foreign policy with U.S. strategy and geostrategy. There are several examples in recent years. For example, the U.S. Senate approved the law related to the government of Ecuador, which is called the Cooperation Act between the United States and Ecuador, a law to rule another country. The United States passed a law for Ecuador that covers all areas of life in our country, not only international relations, but also geopolitical order, security, defense, political management, and others. This is an important precedent. This law was passed in December 2022. Then during this process, we saw a diplomatic, or as you said, a military offensive, Southern Command. And what happened a few days ago in Ecuador are examples of this. Therefore, here we see the deployment of military force, which is against the Constitution, because the Constitution has introduced Ecuador as a country of peace without the presence of military bases and military aggression, especially foreign bases. Even in national definitions, the culture of peace is emphasized. Now, in such a country, a very detailed military cooperation agreement is signed. With the military agreement between the United States and Ecuador in October, there is no more talk of 1, 2, or 3 military bases. It's about handing the country over to intelligence operations and diplomatic exercises. In this agreement, it's guaranteed that all operations, personnel, intelligence services, etc., will have diplomatic immunity and will be subject to American laws, despite the fact that they're in Ecuador. It is difficult for me to explain this issue because it is both in the approved law, which we mention as an unprecedented case, that a law is approved in the United States to govern Ecuador, and in the military agreements, because this is not the first agreement. It is said that they're conducting an experiment of a new type of American protectorate, which bypasses the country's laws, constitution, and international agreement in this model in order to direct the country to another destination and another role, which is within the framework of foreign geostrategic design. So that's the path that Ecuador is on. And without a doubt, our recent experience as a country has been a lifetime of chaos. We have the numerous moments of unprecedented, unexpected, and even most unjustified chaos, followed by offers of security. In other words, leaving national sovereignty and becoming a client of private commercial packages of security models like what we currently have in Ecuador. Therefore, what we are witnessing is clearly our concern, because our country, which is defined on the basis of sovereignty, is becoming a protectorate. This is worrying. Another worrying issue is that the country has gone as far as declaring a civil war. That is what the president of Ecuador has announced. He has the military support of the Southern Command, the regime of Israel, and the government of Ukraine. He received a military plane from this country, which is an American aid received this week. This is an international invasion against a Latin American country that includes a declaration by CELAC, Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which declares the region a land of peace. They brought the country into an unexpected military situation. In fact, numerous riot and violence tactics have been implemented in Ecuador with the aim of offering settlement packages to it.
Distintas aplicaciones de tácticas de violencia y de caos para luego ofrecer también paquetes de solución.
Así es, para ir acercándonos ya al final.
Yes, that's right. What has been the reaction of the Ecuadorian people, the people who have established various movements? Where is the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador? What about the Federation of Secondary Students of Ecuador? What about the Federation of Students, Trade Unions, National Union of Teachers? I mean, we have witnessed large demonstrations since the past. What happened to the democratic forces or patriotic forces? In such a difficult situation for Ecuador, what are the conditions of these groups? This could be a bad example, as you explained, and the path that they set for all of Latin America.
Yes, that's right. I believe that these techniques of developing chaos and intimidation of people, especially in the case of Ecuador, which until recently was known as the axis of peace in the region, will lead people to an unexpected reaction. For example, the fear that is instilled through really effective media work against these threats has an impact on ordinary people and on the economy and on all aspects of life. And without a doubt, it cannot be denied that the people of Ecuador are intimidated. For example, since the declaration of civil war under the heading of terrorism, which targets the smallest common criminal and the biggest leader of drug trafficking, there's been confusion in the country, and people want these issues to be resolved so that they can act more freely. When the country is stopped due to the declaration of this war, we're facing unusual conditions in all fields, and it is clear that society has many questions. Not only experts, but also common sense says that for the problems that exist in Ecuador, maybe it was possible to solve them with techniques focused on the same issues. Issues such as violent and dangerous acts. It would have been better if we had not declared war across the border and asked for help from the Southern Command and other actors, such as the extreme right-wing government of Argentina, to solve the country's problem. With these talks, the popular and social movement, which is very diverse in our country, was worried and expressed dissatisfaction with the current situation and asked for an explanation. The network of intellectuals defending humanity, the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador, and other institutions have expressed concerns about these conditions, especially because of these declared war conditions. Democratic capabilities are limited.
Se obstruyen las capacidades democráticas.
El tiempo es cruel.
Time is cruel. For this reason, we say goodbye to Irene Leon, who has an excellent and very powerful presence. Thank you, Irene Leon. This is Black and White.
Esto es negro y blanco.
I should always thank the Black and White program. Thank you. See you soon.
Hasta pronto.
Hasta pronto.
See you soon.
a diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Doctors at the University of California, San Diego's Health Trauma Center have treated 455 patients with serious injuries sustained whilst trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in 2023. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge has sharply questioned the Biden administration's position that it is not responsible for housing and feeding migrant children while they wait in makeshift camps along the U.S.-Mexico border. Recent media reports have shed light on the harsh conditions at sites along the border, where people waiting for processing by U.S. immigration authorities live under open skies, or in tents, or in structures made of tree branches. The camps are often short on food, short on water and sanitation, relying on groups of volunteers to distribute aid and basic supplies. Border Patrol does not dispute the conditions at these camps. Rather, the question at issue is whether these people are in legal custody, which would start a 72-hour limit on how long children can be held and require emergency medical services and guarantees of physical safety, among other things. At a hearing in Los Angeles, California recently, the U.S. District Judge Dolly G said evidence presented by migrant advocacy groups appeared to support the definition of legal custody. She asked, are they free to leave the camp? Fiza Batul, an attorney for the U.S. Justice Department, answered, as long as they do not proceed further into the United States. U.S. District Judge Dolly G, who was appointed by Bill Clinton, acknowledged it was complicated, like dancing on the head of a pin, because some children arrive on their own at the camps and are not sent there by Border Patrol agents. U.S. District Judge Dolly G did not rule after the half-hour hearing. Advocates are seeking to enforce a 1997 court-supervised settlement on custody conditions for migrant children, which includes a time limit and services such as toilets, sinks, and temperature controls. Children traveling alone must be turned over within 72 hours to the U.S. Health and Human Services Department, which generally releases them to family in the United States while an immigration judge considers their case for asylum. Asylum-seeking families are typically released in the United States while their cases wind through the courts of law. The legal challenge focuses on two areas in California, one between two border fences in San Diego and another in a remote mountainous region east of San Diego. When the number of people crossing the border was particularly high last year, they waited for several days to be arrested and processed by overwhelmed Border Patrol agents. From May to December, agents distributed colored wristbands to prioritize who to process first. Migrant advocates say Border Patrol agents often direct people to the camps, sometimes even driving them there. Agents are often seen nearby keeping a loose watch until buses and vans arrive. The Justice Department, which rejects advocates' label of open-air detention sites, says smugglers sent people to these camps. It says agents giving them water and snacks is a humanitarian gesture, and that any agent who sends or even escorts them there is no different than any law enforcement officer directing heightened traffic to avoid disorder and disarray. Brent Schwertfeger, a senior official in the agency's San Diego sector, said in a court filing, Border Patrol generally arrests people at the camps within 12 hours of encountering them, down from 24 hours last year. The agency has more than doubled the number of buses in the San Diego area to 15 for speedier processing. On Friday, 29th of March, 33 people, including two small children, waited between border walls in San Diego until agents came to ask them to empty their pockets, remove shoelaces, and submit to weapon searches before being taken in vans to a holding station. They were primarily from China and India, with others from Afghanistan, the Republic of Azerbaijan, and Georgia. Border agents spoke to them in English. Pedro Rios, a volunteer with American Friends of Service Committee, delivered turkey sandwiches and hot tea and coffee through spaces in the border wall. He gave pain relievers and ointments to a limping Chinese woman who had fallen from the wall. Doctors have seen a startling rise in injuries related to the border wall, with one San Diego trauma center treating more than 440 patients with serious injuries in 2023 alone. Kellyanne William, a 38-year-old, said she left a 10-year-old daughter with family in Jamaica because she could not afford the journey, including airfare to Mexico, but that asthma would have made the trip difficult for her child anyway. She planned to apply for asylum and settle with family in New York area, having fled her home after family members were killed last year. Kellyanne Williams said she attempted to reach the camp on Wednesday, 27th of March, but fled back into Tijuana in Mexico to avoid Mexican authorities in pursuit. She tried again a day later, waiting 6 hours on U.S. soil for agents to pick her up for processing. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Doctors at the University of California San Diego's Health Trauma Center have treated 455 patients with serious injuries sustained while trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border in 2023, a marked increase from the previous year. Alexander Tenorio, a resident neurosurgeon at the University of California San Diego who treats brain and spinal cord injuries, said 97% of the injuries, or 441 of them, occurred when people fell off the wall on the U.S. side of the border with Mexico. The figure captures just a part of the number of people injured while trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border near San Diego. The center is one of two major trauma centers in the region. Migrants with injuries perceived as less severe may not make it to a hospital, and children are not included in the data set. Still, they highlight the extensive and growing human toll of the border crossing. In 2022, the trauma center recorded 311 injuries relating to people scaling the wall. In 2021, it recorded 254 injuries. In 2020, there were 92 injuries, and in 2019, there were 42 injuries. Tenorio said a lot of these patients come with fractures all over their bodies. Unfortunately, and that's what you would expect if someone falls 30 feet from a wall, it's like a three-story building. Dr. Tenorio said the patients arrive at the trauma center with broken limbs, abdominal organ injuries, facial injuries, and spinal fractures. Dr. Tenorio said a lot of these injuries unfortunately don't heal on their own because they're so severe and extensive. He added, A significant number of patients end up undergoing emergency craniotomies or spinal cord surgery. Of the patients who underwent these spinal cord surgeries, Dr. Tenorio said, only 14% came back for a clinic visit, making long-term outcomes difficult to assess. In 2023, Dr. Tenorio said, the center for the first time saw more women than men admitted to the hospital for border-related injuries, including falls.
In May 1945, a group of experts prepared a base to detonate 100 tons of TNT. They were busy finding an appropriate criterion to measure a huge bomb in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The volume of the explosives should have been so large to simulate the main test. In the middle of all this, the differences of opinion between two groups of scientists over the secretive Manhattan Project grew larger. This group of scientists, who were supposed to change the mid-20th century's fate, could not reach an agreement on a certain issue. Most of them were of the opinion that after making an atomic bomb, the United States should put its power on display at night for Japanese envoys in order to make the Japanese emperor surrender by threatening him with the bomb. However, theoretical physicist Edward Teller insisted on testing the atomic bomb on a city to learn about its effects on its population.
The American people in there.
The only thing that could put an end to the differences was the speech by then US President Franklin Roosevelt for the scientist. It tipped the balance in favor of Teller.
Among other things, and at the climax, he said, "You scientists are blamed for the weapons to be used. But I tell you that if you now won't work on weapons, the freedom of the world will be lost." Now, you know, I had the feeling that Roosevelt was talking to me. I was there when the letter was signed that awoke his interest in nuclear energy. I thought I knew he was talking about nuclear energy. Of the 2,000 scientists there, I felt he was talking to me.
Some people consider Edward Teller as a clear example of a mad scientist. Many critics believe that Stanley Kubrick was inspired by Edward Teller to create the notorious character Dr. Strangelove.
The report, my conclusion, was that this idea was not a practical deterrent for reasons which at this moment must be all too obvious.
Then you mean it is possible for them to have built such a thing?
Mr. President, technology required is easily within the means of even the smallest nuclear power. It requires only the will to do so.
After the TNT explosion test, it was eventually decided that the first bomb should go off in Alamogordo, which is located 230 miles south of New Mexico in Los Alamos. The operation was codenamed Trinity. The codename comes from the belief in the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in Christianity. They were planning to launch the largest massacre of human beings in the name of Jesus. This 21-ton bomb was 200 times stronger than the calibration test. The light was so intense that could immediately cause blindness. It was visible within the radius of 16 kilometers. It melted the sands in the desert and turned them into green crystals. The radioactive effects remained in the region for 50 years. Before the bomb was tested, two other bombs named Little Boy and Fat Man were secretly taken to Oceania to be prepared for an attack on two Japanese cities. It was 8:15 a.m. local time on August 6, 1945. The first bomb, Little Boy, was dropped on Hiroshima by a bomber named Enola Gay. For the bomber to have enough time to flee the explosion, they dropped the bomb via a parachute. To make the detonation stronger, the bomb was set to go off 576 meters above the ground. Those who saw Little Boy explode mid-air from a distance said they saw a new sun in the sky. After the blast, two-thirds of the buildings in Hiroshima, including steelmaking and industrial factories, were completely destroyed. The only thing that was left standing in the city was the Hiroshima Prefectural Industrial Promotion Hall. The explosion happened on top of the building's dome, and as it was within the central focus of the blast, it was not completely devastated. The moment the bomb went off, about 100,000 residents in Hiroshima died on the spot. While Japan was in shock and the Japanese people had almost realized that they were defeated, then US President Harry Truman announced that this bomb was just a warning. 3 days later, another bomb was detonated in Nagasaki, which claimed the lives of 40,000 people in that city. The next day, Japan conceded defeat and surrendered to US conditions to end the war. In the following years, more people succumbed to injuries sustained after the explosion due to radiation. Even though the US honored its forces who were involved in the Manhattan Project and the agents in the carnage were awarded, the events pushed the public to rise up against nuclear weapons. The harms caused by the newly invented elements were not always sudden and tangible like atomic bombs. The start of nuclear war dated back to 50 years before, when radioactive material was first discovered. In the spring of 1896, Marie Curie and her husband, Pierre Curie, discovered the amazing characteristics of some mineral stones, including uranium. They realized that the elements in the stones emit radiations that are not visible but pass through many barriers. The radiation was named gamma. After her husband's death, Marie Curie continued her research in 1910. It led to the discovery of radium as a new radioactive element. The discovery made her the first woman to receive the Nobel Prize twice. But the award cost Marie Curie a lot. Many doctors say she was a victim of radioactive material, especially radium, during her experiments in the lab. The possibility was raised in the following years because back then nuclear scientists did not know anything about the harmful effects of nuclear material. It caused bigger catastrophe. The discovery of radium among natural radioactive elements with the half-life of about 1600 years left everyone in astonishment. The element's strange radiation added new color to advertisement in the West. Since the damage caused by the element and its radiation hadn't come to light yet, opportunistic traders sought to fulfill people's demands with these elements. They claimed that this dangerous material can help him live longer and healthier, so they introduced it to people's daily lives. They were used in the most sensitive cosmetic and hygienic products, including body lotions, lipsticks, toothpaste, and even water, bread, and chocolate. They claimed that radium as an ingredient in products is considered something positive. On the other hand, in 1917, the United States had just been involved in World War I. The army needed clocks whose hands were luminous at night in the dark. So factories across the US took up the job and started producing clocks. To paint the tiny impact numbers on the clock's screen, they instructed female workers to press the tip of the brush with their lips in order to keep it tiny. They were told that working with radium paint was not hazardous. After a while, some of the workers were diagnosed with strange diseases. They would go to the dentist to pull their decayed teeth, but not only wouldn't they be cured, their teeth would get injured. Things gradually got worse. After dentists touched their jaws, they would get injured. Many of them had cancerous tumors in their bones and they would easily break. The first person who died was a 25-year-old woman named Amelia Maja, nicknamed Molly. She succumbed to the disease in less than a year. The doctors didn't have an answer to her mysterious death. Gradually, as more and more female workers came down with illness, they pieced together the puzzle and found out that radium was the reason behind the deadly disease. Although, after 5 or 6 years, in the mid-30s, advertising products that contained radioactive elements and using them in products were altogether banned, their effects continued to last. After the atomic bombing in the World War, the radium girls and similar incidents like the Chernobyl disaster in Ukraine in 1986 and the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in 2011 after the 8.9 strong earthquake, the international community rose up against nuclear energy. But the question is, why do countries, even Japan that was subject to the biggest atomic curse, not give up nuclear energy? Why does a country like Iran make so much effort and spend so much money to achieve such an apparently dangerous energy? West Asia is known for its wars. The wars were initially waged under different excuses, but they usually pursue the same goal, and that is oil. The United States' latest direct war in the region was launched in 2003. The US invaded Iraq under the pretext that the country possessed weapons of mass destruction, like biological and nuclear bombs, but after years of war and bloodshed, no weapons that were used as a pretext to invade the country were found. Even though no unconventional weapons were found in the country, it was rich in oil resources that was hugely extracted. After the invasion, oil was extracted and used to push US policies and economy forward. The US dealt with Iraq and raised accusations that are somehow similar to Israel's behavior vis-a-vis Iran.
This is a fuse. That Iran has another secret facility in Tehran. A secret atomic warehouse for storing massive amounts of equipment and material from Iran's secret nuclear weapons program. we exposed the site of Iran's secret atomic archive. It's right here, in the Shorabad district of Tehran. Today, I'm revealing the site of a second facility, Iran's secret atomic warehouse. It's right here, in the Turkuzabad district of Tehran, just 3 miles away.
The Turkuzabad carpet washing center was Netanyahu's last trick for the media to get the international community on board his Iranophobia scheme for, quote, possessing nuclear weapons. But the Israeli regime did not stop there at the media campaign level. To date, it has assassinated top Iranian nuclear scientists. He's someone who doesn't want to realize that based on numerous inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, and the religious views of the Iranian leader, it is not after nuclear weapons.
As of today, I can state that Iran is implementing its nuclear-related commitments. We have had access to all the sites and locations which we needed to visit.
So why does Israel keep insisting on the accusation and pursue such confrontational policies with Iran to stop the country from reaching nuclear technology? Is it possible that the objections are just excuses? Just like what happened in Iraq? How can the energy benefit Iran that the Israeli regime does everything it can to stop it from reaching the technology? It was exactly 6 years after the first and last nuclear bomb blast that a national lab in Idaho was lit up by only 4 200-watt light bulbs. Even though the EBR-1 project's goal was not to generate electricity, it corroborated theories concerning producing electricity from nuclear energy. The system, which was more complicated than making an atomic bomb, was later named nuclear reactor. The reactors could easily provide electricity for a city or more without constructing huge dams or consuming thousands of tons of charcoal and emitting pollutant gases. 70 years after the 4 famous light bulbs in Idaho were lit up, a little further away, Bill Gates, as the richest man on the planet and the owner of Microsoft, was investing on nuclear reactors that could work for 60 years after fueling just once. Today, reactors have considerably reduced consumption of oil condensates for producing energy. For example, the 1,000-megawatt reactor in Iran's Bushehr has saved 47 million barrels of oil that would otherwise be used for generating electricity in 7 years. In Europe, generating electricity is the foremost goal of using nuclear energy for peaceful purposes, but in Asia, there is a more burning issue, and that is water. West Asia is among the driest regions in the continent. It has only 1% of fresh water resources in the world. Many analysts believe that the next wars in the region will not be over oil. They say water is a serious concern in this part of the world. In this dry region, Israel has managed to export its agricultural products to all across the world, besides meeting 95% of its population's demands. The Israeli regime does not have underground water resources or many rivers. However, it has tipped environmental balance in its own favor by using nuclear technology to rein in nature. On the shores of the Red Sea, the saline water is desalinated for agriculture and drinking. As an example, Sarek, as the largest water treatment plant in the world, located 15 kilometers south of Tel Aviv, can purify 230 million cubic meters of water and tackle water shortage to a great extent. This amount of water is equal to the water Iran annually receives from the Karajan Latian dams for drinking and agriculture in Tehran and Elbourz provinces with a population of about 15 million people. Even though only 20% of the land occupied by the Israeli regime is arable, today it has become an agricultural hub.
This is the finished product, desalinated water. And according to the officials here at the plant, it's a more complete water than water that hasn't had the saline removed, because in the process of desalination, minerals are added back.
It seems the Israeli regime and Washington are seeking to stop Iran from accessing nuclear energy, not because they are worried it might make a nuclear bomb, but they are concerned that Iran might achieve the nuclear technology that can strengthen its independence and tackle millions of Iranians' needs. Water and energy are among the most vital necessities in agriculture and other industries, and even if a country like Iran does not need nuclear energy to fulfill its needs, it still cannot forego the energy. If the fruit produced by farmers goes bad before reaching the market, it will bring nothing but financial loss and physical exhaustion. Many kinds of fruit cannot resist against natural bacteria and fungus as they quickly go bad. Today, the key to reach the market, especially the international one, is in the hand of irradiation. Thanks to nuclear technology, radiation technology has been around for 60 years and is used in the agriculture industry. Exposing fruits to the light emission of radiation for a short time can destroy the larvae and bacteria in fruits and increase its shelf life. Today, many agricultural products and even fruits like strawberry that have very short shelf life are exported to other countries. Exposing fruits to the gamma ray at entry points and quarantine centers of a country can stop the spread of insects and pests.
We have to look at the taste, the color, the granulometry. Is there some foreign material? And also we look at the microbiology. Spices can be contaminated up to 1 million bacteria per gram. And with the irradiation, it can reduce by 99.9%. Other treatment will not offer that kind of reduction. Irradiation for us will not change the taste, the color, will not leave any residue, and also is really lowering the microbiological count.
When we piece together different problems like medical treatment, industrial experiments, and other issues a country can resolve by using the nuclear technology, we find out that there is a good reason behind Iran's political and economic battle to achieve the technology. Today, if a country wants to guarantee its economic, scientific, and technological future, it needs to step in this field.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahth al-Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became a supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Ma
back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mama Jawad, hosting this program. Asha Chowdhury, guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to travelers based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, what's the rule of the prayers and fasting of those individuals who travel for an indefinite period, such as the students of Islamic studies, all right, who go to the Islamic seminaries, or government employees who are transferred to a certain city for work purposes for an indefinite period?